This week on C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast, journalist Jane Marie reports on how multi-level marketing businesses, also known as MLMs, make their profits. She's interviewed by Business Insider senior correspondent Emily Stewart.
Hi, it's Kayla from C-SPAN. Imagine 45 years ago when there was just a handful of television networks. C-SPAN first went on the air bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Greta from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of our four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I am a longtime fan, feel like this is a real first time caller, longtime listener situation. Before we hop in, I just wanted to say I have this really great business opportunity for you that I think you'd be into. And I'm obviously, obviously joking, but that's kind of what brings us here today, sort of that line that a lot of us hear from a lot of people in our lives who are into multi-level marketing or MLMs. And I guess since maybe a lot of people have never heard of MLMs before, or they've heard of them and they don't know what they are, to sort of just like to set the table, I want to know if you could just talk through a little bit like what you're talking about in your book. Like, what market are we addressing here? What are we talking about?
Sure. Well, we're not addressing a market. I'll get to that in a second. We are talking about an industry. This took years to really try to distill down a definition, but MLMs, if anybody's heard of them, they would have heard of Amway, Herbalife, lately the LuLaRoe, because they got, you know, in a bunch of trouble for selling crappy leggings and stuff. Avon, Tupperware, Mary Kay, those kinds of companies are all MLMs. And the way MLMs work is, so it's shaped like this. There's a person who owns the MLM, and then there's like a line of recruits, and then all those people recruit people, and then all those people recruit people, and it's supposed to kind of spread out, and you earn money off of all the sales of the people underneath you. But what really happens is that the people on the bottom rung have to pay a fee to get in, and the system is designed sort of to fail, which means that the people paying to get in, very few of them stay in, but there's like an endless supply of people that want to get in at the bottom because the promise is really good. The promise is great. Like, if it was true, it'd be awesome. I would do it. But the promise is really good. So the people pay a couple hundred bucks, $200, $500 to their upline. And that money gets distributed up this shape. Mm-hmm. And then they quit because they can't make any money. And then another set of people does the same thing. And that's how all MLMs operate. Only 1% of participants make or don't lose money. I think it's 99% lose money trying an MLM. So it's just it's a story. It's more a story than a business.
Right. And he said 99% of people fail. So basically, yeah, Nobody makes money on this except for the people at the very bottom or at the very top.
Right. And I think it's what's interesting to me is that, like, everyone knows, like, the restaurant business, for example, is very hard to succeed in. I feel like profit margins are like 11%, and, you know, almost all of them shut down too, but they're, at least it's talked about that way. You know, if you were to tell someone I'm going to start a restaurant, they'd go, ooh, you know, like, good luck. Mm-hmm. With MLMs, it's talked about like, oh, I can't wait to go on your yacht, you know, when you've made $1 million. Like, we don't tell each other, and we don't, the people in the organization don't tell each other how impossible it is. And that's kind of what we're trying to change.
So I guess I want to get to that, But I did want to back up a little bit to what got you into this in the first place. Like, I think we have similar backgrounds. I'm also from the Midwest, and I grew up around Mary Kay and Avon. And like, to be honest, I didn't realize until even 5 years ago that those were MLMs. Like, why? Just don't start. But why talk about this? Why delve into this? Why look at this?
Well, the story is that a producer at Stitcher years ago called me to see if I wanted to produce a show about MLMs, kind of knowing I'm from the Midwest and all that. And I kept her on the phone for like an hour, just regaling her with stories about my grandma and stuff. And then they were like, well, why don't you just make this show? So then I did and became even more obsessed than I already was with that world. And it kind of took off from there.
Mm-hmm. And I know, I mean, I guess like, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but are they always bad? Are they always, I guess the answer for you is yes. I mean, do you think that there's any kind of silver lining here where people who do feel like, okay, whatever, like my leggings suck, but like I enjoyed my time selling them or I had my Mary Kay parties. Do you feel like there's any kind of redeeming quality here?
Definitely. There's a social, aspect to all of them that's really important for a lot of people. Again, my problem with it would be, yes, you can get a lot of social interaction out of it. You can get accolades. You get to go on vacations. You don't have to be around your kids 24/7. All of this stuff's great. It would be better if it were sold as a club or kind of, I always think of beauty pageants, like, in a beauty pageant, your chance of winning is like almost nothing and you pay a lot of money to be in it, but it's mostly for the fun of it or like, to kind of dress up and things like that. And if it were marketed that way, again, I wouldn't have a problem. But if you ask, are there any good MLMs? I think that the very structure of this business is bad. And I don't think there's a way. I just don't trust that anyone who has a real product couldn't sell it for more in the real marketplace. If it's a good, real product, why do you have to keep it behind closed doors? Why does it have to be, door-to-door sales in this day and age? Like, that it doesn't make sense unless you understand that the money isn't really coming from that.
Right. Yeah. In the book, there was one section, I think, on sex toys of all things and a woman who was selling them. And then I remember, being like, you could get this a lot cheaper places. So people don't even realize that. Like you're buying things at enormous, you're selling things or buying, I guess, both at an enormous markup where you can get whatever the product is at CVS or somewhere else for a lot cheaper.
It's funny you just said buying or selling. It's both. You are right. You're the same person who is selling is also buying. So, for example, that story was about a woman who worked at Pure Romance, which is like an adult accessories, they call it, bedroom accessories company. And she was encouraged by her upline to stock a bunch of stuff. Like, she wanted to get the smallest starter package and was like talked into spending tons and tons more to make sure she had everything available for samples. She didn't really sell very much. And she was her own customer for the most part, right? Because she's just trying to keep her inventory stocked up with the new products. And the companies also do this thing where they like discontinue stuff and then reintroduce stuff over and over again. So if you do have things in your trunk that you're going to take around to parties, a lot of times you have to check to make sure they're still even available. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be replaced by something else that you have to put in your trunk. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she lost a ton of money doing this, and the number of ways that MLMs keep you in and spending money like that are just countless. I mean, there's like all kinds of stuff that they sell to you, like self-help and conventions and things like that. But yeah, I think I got us off track, but.
No, that's good. I guess, just before we hop a little bit more into the book, can you just kind of talk me through like what the life cycle is for most people into these? A friend approaches you and says, I have an idea or I have a business opportunity. I've been selling earrings, essential oils, whatever. What happens next?
Well, there are two different types of people. one type says, this sounds like a money loser. And so, no, thank you. I'm not going to do it. And then usually your friendship's over for a little while because they're focused on getting all their friends into this company. The other one is some people see the 1% and are like, that's me. I can do that. Or they believe so much in the dream and they have so much hope that they want it to be true that you can do, you know, have no experience, you don't need an education, you don't need any sales experience, you don't even need a phone, et cetera, to do this work and you can become a millionaire. There are people who buy into that right away and I understand why they do. So those folks who do get in usually leave kind of quickly within like 6 months. But a bunch of things happen in that 6 months that can keep you in for a very long time. And some of them are the things I'm talking about with you spending more and more of your own money to rank up, to like, to get higher in the ranks so you can earn a little more commission. People will spend their own money to do that. And then you come to a place where you run into these like logical fallacies that all of us participate in, but basically honoring sunk costs is a big one. So like you spend $10,000, are you just going to quit? Like, or should you keep trying for another year and not realizing that that trying for another year is going to cost you $20,000. So it takes a while. I mean, the people that I spoke to that were really high up have been in most of these MLMs for 10 years or something and has still quit eventually. And I spoke to a guy from Amway that estimates over a 10-year period, he lost $200,000.
Oh my goodness. That's, and he didn't even realize for a lot of it, or did he know?
No,
he didn't know.
He didn't because, well, first of all, the bookkeeping is really dicey. It doesn't, it's not part of the training of any of these companies. So, you know, you're not writing off your gas and your phone and all of this stuff, which is necessary and kind of recognizing the cost of, just the cost of doing business, how many hours you're working. And a lot of people I talk to would do their hours and go, oh, I'm making less than minimum wage. Like, what am I doing? And they do keep, you know, they keep the compliments flowing. They keep the accolades flowing. They keep, you get a small check. So the checks are coming in, but it's not enough to make up for all the money you're spending. And it is easier just to put the blinders on and go, it's got to work one of these days. Otherwise, why would all these people that I really trust be involved in this? Like, I must be doing something wrong.
Right. Well, and also kind of isn't the mantra sometimes, or the idea that if you're not making money, you're not trying enough. You're not trying hard enough.
Right.
It's your fault.
Yes. Right. Yes. Because no one's, like, again, no one's being honest. So, like, the man I'm talking about who lost $200,000, his uplines were telling him that, like, the people above him were saying, that's really weird because I'm making tons of money. It's like so crazy that you're not making money. Truth is, they probably weren't either, but it's the mythology of these organizations. So he really did think, oh, I'm bad at this and I need to train more. And he started buying all kinds of training materials from Amway and just sinking more and more money into this, thinking he was the problem. But when really the problem is they just sell boring soap that's like regular soap. It's very, very expensive soap that doesn't even look that pretty.
I did look up online, because I feel like I've never seen Amway in the wild, and I did look up online
ever
before we came here, where I was like, what do they even sell? I've never seen it, which is very weird. I feel like I've seen the other stuff in the wild.
It's very telling. It's very telling, though, right? Like, they're one of the biggest in the world, and you've never seen it anywhere. What does that tell you? Where is it?
Right.
It's in a trunk or a garage. You know, if it really was that big of a company that couldn't sell at CVS and couldn't get into Target because it's so special, and one in five people, you know, they say one in five people has an Amway product in their home. And I don't know. I'm from Michigan and I don't even know people that have Amway products.
It's really strange. It's not, it's separate, very as much an aside, but I've even been asking around in my life and nobody has seen it. And I've just been like, well, where is Amway? But different day. So I did want to, you know, obviously dive in a little bit more into the book. And, you know, the title on this is Selling the Dream, which obviously refers to the American dream here. And you talk about in the book, like, there are these ideas of, like, limitless potential, that, you know, anything can be achieved with optimism and willpower. And those are very quintessentially American ideas. What do you think about MLMs makes them, you know, they they obviously are, many of them are multinational, but what is American specifically about them?
Well, they were built on that philosophy. I mean, mm-hmm. the men who started MLMs were mm-hmm. totally like capitalist, rugged individualists who believed that they were growing up in a meritocracy in the early 20th century mm-hmm. and did believe in bootstrap thinking and that sort of thing. So it's, chicken and the egg, what came first? Well, the hope and the dream came first. And then these people, can't tell you how intentional it was, but they exploited that. I mean, exploiting hope is very profitable, as we know. And so it taps into that thing that we're all raised with still to this day, that this place is great, that anybody can make it if they try hard enough, that, that again, we're a meritocracy, that it doesn't matter where you come from mm-hmm. or how much you have or don't have, this is the land of opportunity. And people who, want to profiteer from that essentially can. And it's totally understandable that they would. I mean, I don't think it's understandable and I don't think that they're good people, but it's not that hard. It's not that hard to take a big group of hopeful people who mm-hmm. feel like they're exceptional, who feel mm-hmm. like they are different than the rest of the world and in a special way, and who feel like there is money to be had out there just sitting around because look at Donald Trump. Well, what we know now is Donald Trump doesn't even have money. But for a while, he ran an MLM and he's been mm-hmm. a spokesperson for MLMs. And for a while, people would look at him and I think secretly think he's a dunce, and he's a billionaire. So I can do it,
Right.
And he's telling me to do it. He's saying that the MLMs help you get there. And I believe he's a billionaire. Well, now, again, we know because of the court cases, but also because he can't pay his $450 million fine. That guy doesn't have money. Just like the uplines who don't make any money. I think it's, it's the kind of the same thing. But you have these sitting ducks in us, mm-hmm. regular people who have since kindergarten or earlier been pledging allegiance to the flag and been talking about, how what college we're going to go to and what, what do you want to be when you grow up, as if mm-hmm. Astronaut is even a possibility. Side note, I found out that astronauts are actually just mechanical engineers when I was way too old to find that out. I thought they were, I don't know what I thought they were, but they use wrenches and stuff. They build things in space. Oh. And I was maybe I could have been an astronaut, but we tell kids that you can do, sky's the limit basically. And I don't think that's a bad attitude so long as no mm-hmm. one's taking advantage of it.
Right.
And yeah.
I learned that about astronauts in this very moment. who knew? You did mention, the men who founded a lot of these MLMs in the 20th century. And I think, obviously today, it's very much seen as women do MLMs. I mean, I joke mm. maybe, crypto is MLMs for boys, but MLMs is MLMs for girls.
Are MLMs for boys that are really close to crypto stuff, though. I will say there are MLMs for dudes that are all finance, telecom, things like boy stuff. There's plenty of those. Yeah.
But a lot of it, especially in the 20th century, is women selling perfumes, essential oils, Mary Kay, Avon. Mm-hmm. Even Tupperware was a woman named Brownie Wise, but it was Earl Tupper who founded it. What are the gender dynamics here? If these guys are founding these companies, why couldn't they sell their stuff?
So, the first answer is that it really was in the very beginning a great idea to have women as your sales force, because we're talking about a time where it was around just after the Industrial Revolution and around the time that cities were happening and there were big urban centers all over the place. But at that time, most people were living in rural areas up until a couple of decades into the 20th mm-hmm. century. So people were living in rural areas and they were getting a lot of their products from door-to-door salesmen or, a Stanley brush or Fuller Brush Company or Stanley Home Products come and buy your house. They went to my grandma's house. I remember that, and my grandma talks about it very fondly. But these were all itinerant dudes who maybe weren't from your community and didn't, like, our milkman when I was growing up was from like Saginaw, which is like an hour from my house. So I don't know anything about him other than he showed up at our house and had a key and walked in and put the milk inside if we weren't home, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think they, early on, the founders of these companies thought, well, what if we had like ladies doing it? And then they thought, what if we had those ladies recruit their friends into doing it? And then you start to see this big group, because it's like 75 to 80% of all MLM participants are women. You start to look at this, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but you start to look at them as a group. What do they have in common that looks attractive to an MLM these days, right? Because we don't need to worry about door-to-door salesmen creeping people out or like going into strangers' homes anymore. That's not the issue that we're trying to solve with MLMs now. So what do they have in common now? They have, you know, difficult economic prospects. They're mothers. A lot of them stay at home moms, a lot of them Christian. So their belief system is that they should be at home with their children. A lot of them are employed and don't make enough money. Pay gap. Hello. So there's an opportunity to sell them this on like, don't you need extra money? Yes, of course I need. Yes, I need 25. I need the 25% that my male coworker is getting. So I guess I'll do an MLM because I can't fix the system, right? And I'm being serious about that. Like, that is the thinking. It's like, how could I ever get ahead? How could I ever, you know, leave my husband? How could I ever? And we've done a lot of, we've gone to these conferences and stuff where people will talk about the reason, the monetary reason that they got into MLMs. And a lot of times it's just for fun, but a lot of times it's really sad. Like, a woman who needed to pay for her dad's headstone. He hadn't had one for 3 years. She was working for 3 years in this makeup MLM and didn't make enough money to buy a headstone in that much time. So I think as a group, women are vulnerable in that way. And it's also true that other vulnerable groups are becoming, are like racing, you know, like competing with women now at, to be like the big group of an MLM. So you have a lot of immigrants, you have a lot of people in developing countries or neoliberal societies that are kind of just beginning their capitalist experiment that we started a long time ago, and they're perfect targets for these companies. So it's just kind of turned out that this good idea for sales is also a really good idea for scams.
Well, it makes sense. You know, in 1920, you don't want a creepy guy in your house. It makes more sense if it's a woman, and better if it's a woman who's your friend. And maybe now they're not showing up at your house, but they're showing up in your Facebook feed on like Facebook.
They're in your
Live.
Yeah, or you're at church or whatever. But also, you know, the women, these the recruitment process requires a large social network and trust. So, you know, trust the story that I'm telling you because it's not true. The recruitment has gotten easier at least recently because of social media. So in the last like 10, 20 years, it's been easier to recruit people outside of your community. But before that, women had these very, very strong social networks that would happen in the daytime when their husbands were home, you know, the neighbor lady, your sisters, your aunts, your grandma. And that's what happened in my family, was one person joins, then the next person joins, and the next person joins, and the next person, and then all of a sudden everybody's selling Herbalife. You know, that's just literally what happens over and over again in my family. Right now, the popular thing in my community, you felt like what?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, the one in my neighborhood that's really taking off right now is what, like, there's a couple different companies that sell those nail stickers, like the nail polish stickers.
The nail polish.
And my mom's next door neighbor can't sell them because it's an MLM and you can't sell them. So every time I go home, she like lets me rifle through this giant basket she has of like thousands of these sets of nail stickers and takes them home. But yeah, they have fun.
It is. I can tell in my hometown just by observing from afar, kind of, I can tell the girl who is like the top of the pyramid usually, and then I can see everybody else get into it, and then it changes. It's very funny how it cycles through and how people don't quit. I mean, they quit one MLM, but then they pick up and do another one a lot of the time, right?
Yes. Because you have to It's so hard. It's so much inner psychology. So, okay, if you figure out you're not making money at this one MLM, in order to quit and not want to do it again, you have to first identify as a victim. You have to understand that you are a victim. You have to understand that probably during your tenure there, you victimized other people, right? You roped them into this thing and they're not making money either. And they happen to be your sister. So you have to like recognize those two things. You have to also know that it wasn't your fault, that it wasn't what you were doing wrong. And instead what happens, the story that gets told often is that wasn't the right MLM and I didn't have the right attitude about that product. So I'll quit this one, but I still believe in the dream. So we talked to a woman named Anjetti who failed miserably at like a number of MLMs. And I thought we were doing this interview like, oh, I'm so glad you came to your senses or whatever. And then at the end, she was like, so now I'm doing Landmark, which is another MLM. I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, we had a laugh about it, but I was like, you didn't learn anything from this? And she's like, no, I really think it's a good idea. Like, I want to make money. I was like, you're not, this isn't, it's not working.
Yeah, it is tricky. This is, and then I'll, well, next question. Years ago, I worked on a story about these $5 earrings that were an MLM, and it was a horrible story. They had a conference in Las Vegas, and it was a super spreader event. And multiple people who had attended died of COVID. And
oh my God.
It was awful. And I still follow some of the ones who had spoken out on Facebook or whatever. And I do see how many of them are still doing, you know, and you'd think you had just like a horrifying experience. And obviously, I don't want to be judgmental towards people, but it's wild how they say, well, this one was bad, but the other ones are good. And it's the same pressure mechanisms that they just repeat over and over again, which I guess does bring me kind of to where I wanted to go next, which is, you know, how do they get you in these MLMs? You had a story about one of these, it was called Holiday Magic, where they would, I really laughed at this part, they had a manual that would teach you about how to get a pen into someone's hand to sign, paper to sign
drop
up.
The pen, but, and then have them pick it up and then kind of back away.
Yeah,
and then just
really
hold
had quite
paper.
A laugh. I'm like, just sign this paper. You don't know what's going on here. But, you know, what are some of the tactics that they use, I guess, to initially, like, to get you in besides the promise? Like, are there any certain, like, tactics that just have stood out to you in terms of, like, how do they get you?
Well, one tactic that I learned about more recently is this thing that I learned from Jennifer Ryla, who was an Arbonne salesperson for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's called dripping. I thought it was so weird. But it's called dripping. And you essentially create a target list, like a list of people you would like to recruit. And for a while, you drip on them, meaning you gift them things or you invite them to the parties, but you don't pitch the business opportunity, but you just keep in touch, text them every once in a while about something unrelated, give them another candle, et cetera. Do that for long enough. And then you pounce when you feel like they're ready to sign up. And she has a notebook. I've seen it in person. That was called her drip list. That was like a 3-ring binder with just tons of names, addresses, information about the people, like when is their birthday? Who are they married to? You know, like a dossier essentially about her entire neighborhood and everyone she knows and how to drip on all of them to turn them into recruits. That was an interesting attempt, but even lately I've just seen it's kind of sad. I was at the airport going to Michigan for Thanksgiving, I believe. And, there was an Amway lady in one of the restaurants just walking up to people, strangers, with her briefcase. And I was like, I wonder if she's even going anywhere, if she bought like a really cheap Spirit Airlines ticket just to like hang out in the airport.
Just to go hang in the airport. And was she trying to recruit or was she trying to sell?
Yeah.
She was trying to recruit.
Yes. Yeah. She would like chit chat people a little bit and then they would be like, so what are you doing? And she's like, oh, I'm going to a business conference. Oh, you would love it. Like, and then it was like immediately, here's the pitch.
Wow.
And I'm over in the corner of the restaurant being like, it's a pyramid scheme.
Goodness. That is why. So, I mean, does anybody ever want to? I mean, somebody has to come into this thinking they're going to sell.
I have friends, and on the first season of our show, we spoke to my friend Danielle, who is a childhood friend. We grew up together in Michigan, and She is really high ranking in MLM called 31 Bags. It's a Christian bag company.
Okay.
And I think she's like four levels from the top or something like that, and has like in the thousands of people under her. She believed it. She is one of those people that thought she was going to be president from kindergarten. You know, like she just really likes the idea of this society we have going on here and like how she can run it. And she's done really well. But guess what? She works her butt off. I mean, far more than full time, I would say, probably, if she really wrote down the hours. And her biggest take home pay, I think, ever in a year was $45,000. To not actually like get health insurance. They don't have health insurance benefits. There's not a 401k. There's not vacation time. That's for sure. I mean, you can't take a day off because your sales are counted monthly. It's really hard to get any time off in an MLM actually, to get approved time off because your sales, your recruitments count for the whole group. So you're really discouraged from taking your own time. So none of the benefits of a regular job, plus you're only making $45,000 a year, which is not a bad income, I guess, for where I grew up. It's fine. You can live on it, but it's not something to brag about or to rope someone else into, I feel like, unless they feel like it's their calling. Like I know social workers who will take that much.
Right.
But they also get really good government benefits.
Right.
Usually.
If you're the one kind of making the most, and that's kind of that's the ceiling to a certain, I mean, not the ceiling, because there are three other people above you, but if that's the ceiling, like that's not a great place for the ceiling to be.
No. And there are a couple people above her, a couple, you know, but if you think about how many people, the exponential growth of that triangle, right? Two, and then say you have 10 and each of them get five and each of them get five and each of them get five. Once you're down like four or five levels, you're talking hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
And so if these couple up here in the first few rungs are making $100,000, like who cares? I'm not going to be that. Like, how would I leapfrog best friends for one, or like a mom and LuLaRoe, for example, almost everyone at the top of their organization is like related to one another.
No.
So how are you going to squeeze in there? Marry one of them? I don't know. But it just doesn't seem like a good economic plan to think like, well, I'm going to infiltrate this really closed organization at the very top, and then I can make an okay money, you know, okay income. But also Danielle, my friend who does the bags, she's been doing it for like a long time, like 8, 10, 12 years, something like that. Same thing with Jennifer Ryla, who also wasn't making any money, 8 years. Scott, who lost the 200,000, was 10 years or something. So they're, even the ones that are making a little bit of money, it takes a really long time to get up there.
And is Jennifer the one who had the convertible, or is that someone else?
The Mercedes SUV? The white Mercedes SUV? Yeah.
Yeah, and so you just
I
tell
love
that
this story.
That story was actually, I genuinely just wild, because she's someone who outwardly she sells Arbonne, right? She looks like she's succeeding, but she
yes.
So yeah, just tell that story.
But she's not, and she had to. She's now seeing a cult deprogrammer,
like wow,
serious therapy to try to shake it out of her head what happened. So Jennifer was selling Arbonne. Arbonne, if you don't know, is like it's a weird company. It's like diet shakes and makeup.
Okay.
It's like perfect for ladies, you know, just exactly what the ladies need, diets and makeup. And it claims to be like all natural and whatever. But it's, again, it's like you can get that at CVA. Like you can get that at Whole Foods. We all have Whole Foods. You don't have to go to Arbonne to get natural products. But that's what they sell. And they have this program where, just to explain a little bit more about the levels. So, you know, if you're way down here, you're like an associate or a representative or a distributor. And then if you sell or recruit, you know, enough people in a month, it's usually not from selling, it's from recruiting and their signup fees, but they put it in a dollar amount. So like, let's say you recruit five people and they're each $200. And then that means you sold $1,000. Okay. For their starter packs, essentially. So you hit a certain sales goal every month for, let's say, 3 months, and you get to rank up, and it gives you like a couple benefits, like maybe another percent in your compensation or something, or your discount on products and things like that. And so you just try to rank up and rank up. So Jennifer was ranked up pretty high, and a lot of her friends and family had joined her. And one of the levels is, I think, senior vice president, it's called, or senior regional president. I have my book right here, but I'm not going to open it. I'm so sick of looking at that thing. I'm just kidding. It's a great book. So she wanted to get to this certain level, and it's called the Mercedes level. And this will sound familiar to anyone who's heard of the Mary Kay pink Cadillac. In Arbonne, you get a white Mercedes. You get a white Mercedes. You don't get a white Mercedes. So essentially, you get to a level where they allow you to go to your local Mercedes dealership, apply for a loan or a lease in your name. Their name isn't anywhere except on the outside of the car. There's like placards that say Arbonne on the outside of the car, but they don't have anything to do with the actual ownership of the car. And then they set this sales goal. I think for her, it was like 40,000 a month or something for her and her team. And if you hit that every, or 44, maybe a quarter, so it was a lot of money. If you keep hitting that, you get $800 from the company to go toward your car.
So it's just...
like, what? It's just a manipulation tactic to keep you, like, first of all, why not just give them the $800
right.
cash? But it's to keep you roped in. Like, it's to keep you stuck with this company. So now she's paying $800, or she's getting $800 a month a couple of times, but like the goal is so high, the sales goal, and the way she reached it even to get this Mercedes was kind of shady. Like, not shady, she didn't do anything wrong, but Arbonne encourages all of their salespeople, and all MLMs do this, they encourage all of their salespeople to like buy multiples of any new product that's coming out so that they can sell one to their friends and have one in their house and have one in their car and all that stuff. So she did that one time when there was this big new product launch, and her team all bought everything, and then she hit the sales goal. So doing that month after month is kind of impossible. So now she has the Mercedes, and $800 a month, I'm sorry, but a brand new white Mercedes SUV in Northern Michigan, a white car, first of all, what? Dirt roads everywhere? I don't think so. You're not even going to cover the lease, let alone insurance or taxes or anything else. And like, it wasn't even a hybrid. So gas is, it's a gas guzzler. And she still owns it. She's not in Arbonne, but it's her car. She has to drive it around.
So she's like a driving advertisement for Arbonne.
A company she doesn't believe in.
A company she doesn't believe in or work for anymore.
And when I was riding around in it, I wanted to take a screwdriver and like pry off, because it's like a metal sign on the above the wheel well.
Oh my goodness. Arbonne.
And people, also we went mushroom hunting one day. When I was up there, and just to take a load off, and her car, we would like park in a ditch and then go back into some fields and stuff where we knew, where we thought mushrooms were. And I won't tell you any more than that, but people would pull over and be like, Ryla, Jennifer. And because they saw her car, like her car is so recognizable. Everyone in the tiny town she lives in, like, knows that's her. They can just see her everywhere she's going, you know, just like a big red flag.
Oh man. Well, and there's also, there's like a wellness ploy to this, a lot of the MLMs. And obviously we saw this during the pandemic, during COVID, a lot of them discovered that they had ways to help with COVID. But this kind of goes back to the beginning too, right? And Arbonne does this, but a lot of them do this. And even 100 years ago, a lot of these companies were kind of started based on like a wellness promise that I feel like has really seeped into society, right?
Yes. And there's a reason for that as well. So like the earliest MLMs were vitamins. One of the earliest MLMs was Nutrilite, which is now owned by Amway. But the guys who started Amway started at Nutrilite, and Nutrilite existed before that. And it was like vitamins and supplements. I think, and it's since then, that's become a huge share of the product market in MLMs. And I think the reason is because people who, I think if you believe the story about America, there's things that you question that then you question different things. So a lot of people don't trust the establishment. They say, oh, well, everyone's really, you know, there's the pharmaceutical industrial complex, there's the medical industrial complex, there's, you know, the scientists don't want you to know that we actually have a cure for cancer that's really cheap. So this sort of QAnon-y thing, and MLMs kind of go like this. And like a lot of conspiracy theories and stuff about regular products on the regular shelves, like trying to kill you. When in fact, a lot of MLM products have gravely hurt people in the past. But it's like, yeah, this, first of all, you're a big believer in the American dream, but also you just don't trust the guys that are running it right now. That's kind of the combo. I think we all know people like that.
Yes.
And I think, yeah. No, you go ahead.
And there's also like a religious aspect to this too. I mean, there's always the joke that it's like Mormons. Like, why do you think, not that religion plays a role in this, but a lot of Christian communities, this is, MLMs really do take hold. What do you think the connection is there?
Tons of connections. Okay, so we can start with the women again, being asked to stay in the household and not having a lot of economic opportunities outside the house. So this is something that that's deemed acceptable for you to be spending your time doing, especially since you're doing it around your church folks, your friends from church, you know, like who could be mad? I mean, my friend Danielle has her meetings at a church in my hometown. So that's like your husband's fine with that, your pastor's fine with that. So that's one thing. Another thing is that Christians, and I'm only talking Christians here, I didn't do a lot of research into other religions' participation in MLMs, but I did look into Protestants and Catholics quite a bit. And one thing that you're taught in, especially in Protestant churches and evangelical churches and Mormonism, is to proselytize. So it's part of your job as a Christian to spread the word, to tell people and save their souls, right? Which is how you end up with people like going off to weird islands and never coming back. And the skills that it takes to do that kind of work is pretty much the same thing to do recruiting in an MLM. So you're already comfortable with the idea of walking up to someone and offering them this gift of freedom, of, you know, you can finally have what you want in life, and we can do it together. Like, that is all over the place in church. Like, we're helping each other, you know, we're helping each other against the ban, and we're going to, you know, make this community, this little utopia, better for ourselves. And so the idea of knocking on doors or walking up to strangers in a supermarket is not completely foreign to those communities. And then I also think that in some sects of, especially like Calvinism, I spoke about that a lot because that's where the Amway guys got their belief system started in the Calvinist church. And Mormonism is similar, where monetary gains are seen as a blessing or a sign that if there is predetermination, what signs could you look for on earth that you're one of the chosen ones? And those sects have decided that wealth is one of the things you can maybe, it would help you take a good guess if you're going to the good place or the bad place. So again, you get into a chicken or egg thing where it's like a lot of these folks go out with the intention of making a lot of money so that they do. And then it's like, well, why would they send me to hell? Like, I'm working my butt off and I have a bunch of money. I'm a honorable person and I should be rewarded in the afterlife. And I know that's a really big thing in Mormonism. And then lastly, I want to say it, I think also because so many Mormons participate that it has gotten kind of a bad rap for like targeting religious folks. But Utah is the like the home of MLMs. There's more per capita than anywhere, any other state. But that's because they, the people who run that state have created really lax pyramid scheme laws. And MLMs aren't the only scams that are being run out of Utah. There's plenty of others, but MLMs happen to be one of them. So it's kind of like if you've ever started an LLC and your tax accountant will be like, set it up in Delaware.
Right.
Because Delaware has like no something tax. I don't know. Like some tax you don't pay if your LLC is registered in Delaware. It's similar. So if you want to start an MLM, start it in Utah. Because the state won't go after you for a pyramid law violation. Pyramid scheme violations, yeah.
Right. Well, that's, I think, like one of the things that for me about the book, and I remember this from the podcast, that was the most disturbing were the politics here, where you kind of find yourself talking enough about MLMs and worrying enough about MLMs, and ultimately you land at the part of like, well, why the heck doesn't somebody do something about this? This is wild. How is a business allowed to exist where 99% of people fail? I mean, some of it comes from lobbying, right? Like the Amway people have been very,
a lot of it,
very good. And I don't want to just say Amway, but a lot of it is Amway, right? Just kind of being able
it's a lot of Amway, but the DSA, the Direct Sellers Association, which is the MLM lobby, and individual companies do spend a lot on contributions to political campaigns for people who are friendly to MLMs, mostly conservatives, mostly Republicans, mostly people who just love bootstrap thinking. And I think, you know, those, we've seen the political ties. I mean, the Amway dudes were like in government. One of them like was part of the RNC, and the other one, this isn't government, but like was part, it was the head of Chamber of Commerce, and now his kid is. So, which Chamber of Commerce is not a department in the government. It's a lobbying organization, but which I never knew before looking into this stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of politics going on in this world.
But also, like, it is politics on both sides, right? Like, I think that was, for me, has been surprising, where you kind of assume, like, okay, I can understand a world where Ronald Reagan said, go ahead, MLMs, just these, like, you know, the mantra was very much, go ahead, all business. But it really is, like, Republicans and Democrats, at least at the federal level, have not done a lot on this, right?
I think that we are in denial about what we've tasked the FTC with. I think that's the problem is, again, and this is why I like talking about this stuff, because it's stuff people don't know or think about very often. But if you spend a couple minutes thinking about it, it's like, oh my gosh, the FTC, imagine this, you have a whole department of a federal government that has less funding than like a medium-sized MLM, like annual funding. Like if you compare revenues or profit margins on an MLM, the big people up top, not the little guys, to the FTC, they're like tiny, a tiny company. FTC is tiny. I think it's like $350 million a year or something, which is like nothing. Don't quote me on that, but it's somewhere around there. And their job at the FTC is to go after credit card fraud, identity theft, telecom, you know, like spam calls, false product claims, like, you know, or service claims that are wrong, all of the internet phishing stuff, catfishing, all of this stuff, and MLMs. So how to get them to prioritize this thing that has branded itself so well as something good when you have these very obviously bad criminal acts going on, which they don't even have the capacity to stay on top of those. Like getting the momentum of, you know, the country to swing toward let's take out the MLMs is hard, and people are trying, but that's hard to do, especially because when you have like people stealing like old people's identities and credit cards, like that's a, you know, you kind of look at the two of them and you're like, well, these people signed up for it and these people, you know, didn't. And we only have 10 of us here or whatever. I've talked to the FTC a lot and it feels very much like that's the main issue with why they wouldn't put this at the top of their docket, although they are taking it much more seriously lately, especially since COVID. They have been sending out warning letters for false product claims of companies saying our essential oils will cure or prevent COVID. The warning letters, you know, I've challenged them on this a bit, like, what do they really do? Like, are you knocking on doors? Are you going and showing up there and make sure they don't do this stuff? But a new initiative has started a lawsuit, just came out a couple of days ago, a class action lawsuit that might establish distributors as employees, meaning when they go online and claim stuff like our products cure COVID, they're actually representing the company. Right now it's foggy because the company can say, that's just an individual distributor. I didn't tell them to say that, even though they usually, but you know, I didn't tell them to say that. That's not part of our training. And it's just like, that's what everyone else is doing and what you told the uplines to do. But now if they do win this lawsuit and they are, you know, on their way to being held accountable because these people are now considered employees, I mean, that would be great. Like that would solve so many things. Like if they had to, you know, pay taxes in a certain way, if they had to, you know, offer insurance, if they had to give Social Security and stuff like that, like all of that. I mean, it's a huge deal. And I'm keeping a close eye on that one because that would solve a lot of that.
Yeah, because it just, I've looked at this a little bit, but I remember like years ago looking, because I think they do have to kind of disclose like what most people make or whatever. But even that's a lot of the time, if they do disclose it, by the time you're at like the fourth spreadsheet, you kind of can't tell how much money anybody's
making. Oh, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. The public income disclosure statements, I've rarely seen one that's over one page. The compensation packets are so huge. Mm. The thing that will tell you as a seller what you're going to make are so huge and convoluted that like I can't mm-hmm. understand a word. But the sheet that they're supposed to show they don't have to, no one has to, but if by in good faith, like a few of these companies are now doing this, they're like offering up the info. Mm-hmm. And it will be one page. It has a chart that shows you, well, first of all, it's a lot of like inspirational language up at the top. And then there's a little chart that's like, how many people make $1 million? 0.001% of the company. How many people make 500,000? It goes like that. And then it usually tells you like the 99% make nothing or make like $200 a year or something like that. What it doesn't show you at all are the people who fail, the people who drop out. So it doesn't, there should be another row that's like, actually these people quit within the year because they failed and they lost this much. That would be the most informative version of that chart to me. Is if they included that. And I asked the DSA to do it and they wouldn't do it. And they were like, I don't understand what you're asking me. And I was like, I just need to know, you're telling me how much people make and how happy they are, but have you talked to any of the unhappy ones? Like, is that part of your survey? Mm-hmm. And they were like, no. I thought, what are you talking about? This is an incomplete survey. This is incomplete data. If you don't have like what business would do that and like not know their attrition rate? That's not how work works.
Yeah.
Like if Walmart was losing like 99% of their workforce every year, like that would be a problem for Walmart and it would be something they would want to look into. And the MLMs are like, who cares? Right. That's kind of a dumb problem.
Right. I guess, you know, knowing all of this, like, why do you think people keep falling for this? Like, every once in a while, I think, well, Gen Z's smart, and they're all on TikTok. They're going to fix it. They're going to find. Why do we keep falling?
They're all on TikTok selling MLMs.
They're all, yeah, this is the truth. But why do we keep falling?
Well, because it sounds great. And it sounds exactly like the story we've always been told. It doesn't sound out of the ordinary for this culture. Like, it sounds exactly right. Like, it sounds, you can make a living without having to go deeply into student debt. All you have to do is now be online all the time, which you are anyway. And you can have financial freedom and you can spend as much time with your kids as you want to, and you can make as much money as you want to. It just depends on how hard you want to work. You set your own hours. You decide how much to grow your business. All of that, like if that were true, I would do it tomorrow. Like I love the idea of it. And I think a lot of people love the idea of it. And the person giving you the idea isn't giving you the bad side of anything. I mean, they're not saying what really happens. You kind of have to dig for that information. It's only really been in like the last 5 or 10 years that you could get a lot by Googling MLMs. Now, Truth in Advertising has a nice collection of information around the business practices, the dubious business practices at MLMs. And the FTC now has more information on their website, obviously like Reddit groups and Facebook groups that are anti-MLM. And then my show and my book and other shows about this world, but it's been very, very recent. So I think, you know, it, let's say 20 years ago, I wouldn't have even known who to ask if this was a good idea or not. The Chamber of Commerce is certainly not who I can ask because they're run by Amway, you know, and have been forever. So I guess Better Business Bureau or something, but who actually calls them? I don't know.
Yeah, that's when you start to say, well, you know, the FTC, it's like, yes, I feel like I do this for a living and I don't look at the FTC's website as much as, it's like I look enough, but it's not like I do think too, sometimes we only have a few minutes left, but you don't even recognize sometimes that it's an MLM. Like, I think I'm a pretty astute person.
Right.
And I can think 2 years ago when a friend of mine was like, asked me to go to some webinar, and in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, Melanie sells cleaning products now. And it didn't occur to me that it was an MLM. I just thought, well, okay, she's doing something new. So you don't always recognize it either.
Well, they know not to advertise it that way also, you know, not to just walk up to you and be like, are you interested in multi-level marketing? Like, that's not the sales pitch. But they're getting sneakier. I feel like there's more, like, this used to be way against the rules. But they're now getting on store shelves, like making official partnerships with like big brand like Sephora. So like Beauty Counter is an MLM and they sell products at Sephora. I believe they have Tupperware at Target now. So they're kind of blurring the lines. And if you see it on the shelves at Target, does that look like a potential pyramid scheme?
No.
No. Right. And so now why don't you just sell it at home? Not knowing, which we talk about in the book, that Tupperware actually started in department stores and failed miserably and then and then moved over to the party system. But I think they're getting sneakier. They're getting better at the language they use to bring people in so that it's not just red flags all over the place in the beginning. And in my family anyway, people don't talk about, I joined an MLM. They say, I got a new job.
Wow.
That's the phrase.
And so, and then if someone fails, it's kind of embarrassing. You also got your mom and your cousin and your sister-in-law into it, and so you don't talk about it.
The easiest thing to do is, like, it wasn't right for me. It wasn't a good fit, you know? And then you're just on your way to the next MLM or whatever. But I understand that because it's been really hard for everyone I talk to that's, like, especially left after a long time. Like, Jennifer... it's really hard. Like, in my conversations with her, she's having realizations all the time. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I believed that. Or I can't believe I said that to someone. Or, oh my gosh, like it's all just coming up all the time. And she's making apology phone calls all over the place. Like, as she's realizing, it's like coming out of a stupor, you know?
Right. And so you just, once you figure it out, it just takes some time to recognize what happened and you're, you know, maybe $15,000 in the hole.
Yep. Yeah. And with somebody like, so I think about like the victims of Bernie Madoff. So that was a Ponzi scheme, not a pyramid scheme. There was no product involved, but it kind of worked similar. But those folks can say, this is a crime that the SEC goes after, or the other, a lot of departments really want this guy behind bars and can see what's exactly illegal about it and don't have such a problem self-identifying as victims. Even though they did do the same thing by roping their friends and family into it, at least all of them can say, like, point the finger at you. And what MLMs have done by, you know, lobbying for the laws that they have is they protect themselves with this idea of, if we were pyramid schemes, if we were illegal, we wouldn't be allowed to exist. And what I like to say is, that's like saying, I'm not a murderer because I'm not in prison.
Right.
Like, you have to get caught. Someone has to have the resources and the time to do the research and come after you. And we just don't have that right now with the FTC.
Well, I wish we'd ended on a more hopeful note. That's the note that we are going to end
on. It's
going to
be great.
It'll be fine.
It's going to be great. Oh, here's a hopeful note. Here's the cover of my book. It's really pretty.
Oh, I will hold it up too because I have it here. Well, thank you so much. Okay. It was really a pleasure. Bye-bye.
So much fun. Yeah, bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you are interested in podcasts about nonfiction books, listen to C-SPAN's Book Notes Plus podcast for interviews with authors and historians hosted by Brian Lamb.